Podcast.
This is the National Gallery Podcast, and I'm Miranda Hinckley. In this month's episode, Forests, Rocks, Torrents, a new exhibition of Norwegian and Swiss art brings some stunning and rarely exhibited landscapes to London. And artist Grayson Perry tells us why he's so fond of the gallery's collection of early Renaissance art. But we start with our latest exhibition, Devotion by Design. Part of a new series of shows focusing on the permanent collection, Devotion by Design takes a fresh look at the gallery's exceptional collection of Italian altarpieces from the 13th to the 15th centuries. Leah Caribbean went to investigate.
It's not long before the exhibition Devotion by Design opens to the public on the 6th of July, and to show me some of the preparations being made, the exhibition's co-curator Jenny Slivka has brought me up to the gallery's conservation department. Jenny, what is it that we're seeing here?
This is quite exciting. This is Pietro Gerini's baptism altarpiece, which was painted in 1387. And I wanted to bring you up here to show you the work that we've been doing on the altarpiece. It's been up here for just over a year and a half. We first examined it, and we made quite a few exciting new discoveries. And since then, it has also been cleaned and restored. And it's actually quite unusual. It's sort of the first example we have of a baptism that is a narrative scene as the central panel. That's the place, as you know, that you would normally expect to see the Virgin and Child, or one particular standing saint. So it's quite a very special moment in the history of art, actually, as well.
And so we have Christ in the centre being baptised by St John the Baptist, and then two saints to either side in this very elaborate frame. Is that all original?
Actually, it's not. It's very deceptive. It's a close approximation of what we might have seen in the 14th century, but it's entirely 19th century. There's some original bits and bobs, so it's actually been pieced together in the 19th century when it was in a Florentine collection just before we purchased it for the gallery.
But bringing it up to conservation, what have you been able to find?
Well, before we even started cleaning it, we discovered a curious metal bar along the base of the central panel below the baptism. Which just did not fit with anything we know about Renaissance painting. So we removed it, and lo and behold, we discovered an inscription that someone had at one point recorded having seen, but we thought we had lost it forever, and we rediscovered it. So it's kind of an art historian's dream. It had who the altarpiece had been made for, that is the patron, and it also had the date. So that's why we know precisely it was painted in 1387 now.
That's absolutely fantastic. Now, I know this exhibition promises to display altarpieces in ways that will be quite unlike the visitor's usual experience of seeing altarpieces in the gallery, and I'm really intrigued. And I wanted to know in particular, what were your plans for this Gerini?
It's quite exciting. The way we will see the Gerini in the exhibition is very different than how we see it here in the conservation studio under bright natural light. It will be installed in a room that will evoke a Tuscan church circa 1500. So it'll actually be going back in time. And it will be placed on an altar in very low lighting. And some of the light that it might pick up is the flickering of candles. We're actually going to have a particular kind of candles, not real candles, in that room. And the candles will pick up on the gold, of course. But different aspects will fade away and different aspects will reveal themselves, I think, in this darker lighting. Much more akin to how it would have been viewed in the 14th and 15th centuries, I think. And what might come out as these beautiful glowing colours, which have now been revealed after a year and a half of cleaning, that it's been in conservation, these sort of rainbow colours, quite acidic yellows and greens as well, which people, I think, don't necessarily think of when they think of a 14th century painting. It's almost a firework display in some cases.
That sounds as if it's going to be really beautiful. But this evocation of a church setting gets right to the heart of what this exhibition is really trying to do, isn't it? That set these altarpieces in context.
Absolutely. I mean, again, we forget sometimes walking through a gallery, appreciating these works as works of art, that they were created as focuses for devotion. They're devotional objects. And so putting them back into context, you can imagine the rituals, the high mass that was conducted in front of them, the miracles that purportedly happened in front of them as well. It's an idea of reconnecting to their original function.
Jenny Slivka talking about the baptism altarpiece by Gerini. If you'd like to see the work for yourself, Devotion by Design, Italian Altarpieces Before 1500, opens at the National Gallery on the 6th of July. Admission is free. Next, celebrations continue for the 20th anniversary of the Sainsbury Wing. Opened in 1991, this extension to the gallery's main building in Trafalgar Square houses our collection of early Renaissance art. From glittering gold altarpieces to highly detailed portraits, there's plenty to study and enjoy, which is perhaps why, when asked to choose his favourite work in the National Gallery, the artist Grayson Perry answered, "The Sainsbury Wing." Colin Wiggins from the education team took a walk with him around the rooms.
So, Grayson, what is it about the Sainsbury Wing and its difference to the more traditional part of the National Gallery that attracts you?
When I think of my own sort of relationship with art history, you know, my first contact with it was at school arts, you know, lessons. And the book we had was called Giotto to Cezanne, you know, and I can remember hating all those early paintings when we first saw them, and I was like, oh, they're rubbish, they can't draw properly, because, you know, when you're for however old I was at the time, 14 or 15, you've got an empirical view of what painting is, and so if how realistic it is, basically. So all you like really is Salvador Dali and kind of photorealism and album covers. And then, you know, now, of course, here I am, sort of 35 years later, and my love is this sort of the early period, you know, the early Italians and the Flemish painters. And it's very much the very fact that they're not, in some ways, super real is why I like them.
Yeah, we're right at the beginning of the Sainsbury Wing here. And, of course, what it's meant to do is tell a story from this idea that art develops and evolves and that these are the kind of artists that 100 years ago would have been described as primitives.
I think the thing I like about this is the density and the kind of jewel-like quality of the smaller work. You know, their presence as an object is very strong, and you really feel like you could sort of... I mean, some of them are literally standing up in the middle of the room, you know, and you don't get that. And often with the great kind of Titians and Gainsboroughs and paintings like that, I kind of get to them and I love them in a book. And then when I see the actuality of them, they feel like slightly sort of dusty stage sets sometimes, you know, with all the kind of drapery and angels and the fact that it's a bit of cloth. Just as a sculptor, you know, it's unsatisfying to me sometimes. Whereas you go into here and you've got ancient things, objects. They're very much objects. Suddenly they're isolated on the bare walls and they're on wood and they're icons, and you can almost feel yourself picking them off the wall, and the fact they're carried around in baggage trains throughout history. And that's what I really like, you know, about them as a maker of objects and who has a sort of sensitivity to sort of texture and the kind of almost possessable quality of things. You're in an area when a painter is as much a craftsman as an artist, and so therefore he will be aiming at a kind of something that he would have learnt. He wouldn't be expressing himself, he would be perfecting a craft, and a craft is of depiction, and they were kind of wrestling with that craft at the time. And that's what I like about it, is that they tried to do, they might have not had the kind of effects and tools of later artists, but they did have the time and the skill.
Right, yeah, I mean, the craft aspect of the Sainsbury Wing pictures is, to a contemporary audience, fairly astonishing, and that's something that, in a way, we kind of kissed goodbye to at the beginning of the 20th century, when Picasso and Braque start tearing up newspapers and gluing them onto bits of old sack, and Duchamp starts showing bicycle wheels, and craft in the 20th century, with one or two exceptions, just goes out the window. So it's fascinating, I think, for a contemporary audience to just see what art used to be about. And do you regret, in a way, that contemporary art has lost that craft, that skill aspect?
Yeah, to me, sometimes I look at a lot of contemporary art and I just see them as quite sort of badly done illustrations of not particularly interesting ideas. And that kind of relationship with the material and that kind of dual track idea, where you've got, you know, great skill and great sort of imagination and creativity. I mean, there's lots of artists now who are bad craftsmen, and there's lots of craftsmen who are really bad artists. There's very few that are both, you know. And I don't necessarily put myself forward. I always say I'm a conceptual artist masquerading as a craftsman. But when I look at the paintings in this Sainsbury Wing, I sort of still see sort of that kind of golden age of, they almost, you can imagine these people belonging to guilds,
which they did.
Yeah,
they absolutely.
And that did. For me, that is a satisfying thing.
And they had to qualify for their guilds. I mean, it took a long time to train before the guild would have you. And before you were allowed to sign pictures and sell your own pictures and take pupils and things, it was all incredibly regulated. It's also, of course, just the chance of survival, because about 2% of pictures from this period survive.
These are amazing survivors, and I think that's a recommendation to their power as objects, that they were protected, you know, through all different societies that would have had different values. You know, in some, you know, they never were discarded as kind of irrelevant. That's what I like about the art in the Sainsbury Wing.
Grayson Perry talking to Colin Wiggins. And now to a fascinating exhibition in the gallery's Sunley Room. It's called Forests, Rocks, Torrents, and it brings a group of works to London that's rarely, if ever, shown in public. The pictures come from a private collection gathered over many decades by a New York lawyer, Asbjørn Lunde. They highlight the dazzling achievements of landscape painters from two countries we might not readily associate with great 19th century art, Norway and Switzerland, and also reveal the aspiration they shared to found a national identity through their work. Leah Caribbean met curator Chris Riopel as the exhibition was being hung to find out more.
Chris, I have to say that these works are a real surprise. I mean, they're absolutely spectacular. And you've brought me to one in particular, a landscape by Johan Christian Dahl, the Lower Falls of the Labrafoss. And I was wondering if you could begin by describing it for me and also saying, why is it that this picture sort of begins our story?
This painting of 1827 is an early masterpiece of Dahl's in which everything he wanted to say about the rugged Norwegian landscape is there. We're looking at a waterfall tumbling out of the hills, out of the trees, straight at us, and carrying with it logs from a lumbering industry. They pour over the rocks at the bottom of the falls. Everything that was difficult, inaccessible, isolated, but also rich in natural resources about Norway is here.
It's absolutely beautiful, but I suppose the question that springs to mind is, why does Norway need a sort of national school of landscape painting?
The Norwegians were not alone in using landscape to think about themselves, to think about what their lives were like, how they related to landscape. But because the conditions in Norway were so severe, landscape painting there took on a particularly dramatic edge.
Severe in what way? What, the weather?
The isolation of the motifs that these artists were painting, the minimal population, indeed the poverty. Norway in the early 19th century had no political independence, was extremely poor, relied on the export of natural resources, and so to decide to depict that landscape with such pride was a statement of ambition for their country.
That's absolutely fascinating. So do you feel that landscape has this capacity to be emblematic of a national spirit in a way that perhaps other genres don't quite manage?
I think that was one of the great aesthetic discoveries of the late 18th, early 19th century, that yes, landscape, when it was your landscape, could somehow become deeply expressive of who you were as a nation, as a people.
This exhibition is not only about Norwegian landscape painting, but also landscape painting in Switzerland, which again is another real eye-opener. And I was wondering if we could go to perhaps the most spectacular picture in the whole show. This is just wonderful. I mean, this is Torrents with knobs on, isn't it, really? It's by Alexandra Calam, and it's called Mountain Torrent Before a Storm, and it really is spectacular.
Calam, who was the great Swiss painter of the 19th century, and in the 19th century, one of the most famous painters in all of Europe, one of the most expensive painters in all of Europe. He was absolutely adored. This picture that we're looking at went straight from Switzerland to the collection of Prince Yusupov in St. Petersburg.
Wow, so why is it then that we haven't heard about these guys? I mean, they're all amazing.
It is the fate of many of the leading artists of the 19th century. So great was the impact of French Impressionism and later modern styles that a whole tradition of academic painting of the greatest technical skill has been forgotten by most of us.
Right, and so When you look at works like this, which, I mean, it's wonderful to have this collection here in the National Gallery, does it affect the way that you then look at the permanent collection that's here?
It certainly does. Our permanent collection of modern pictures has been traditionally very biased toward the avant-garde, toward French Impressionism and the movements that came after it. This reminds us that there was a whole other tradition of the most extraordinary completeness and vividness living at the same time. We have historically made a choice, but the other side is still there, and slowly perhaps we'll come to appreciate it too.
Yeah, it really is a must-see, I think. A real, real eye-opener. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thanks to Chris Riopel. You can visit the Forests, Rocks, Torrents exhibition in the Sunley Room at the National Gallery until the 18th of September. Admission is free. That's it for this episode. Don't forget you can take a look at any of our paintings online at www.nationalgallery.org.uk, where you'll also find information about upcoming exhibitions and events, including this November's major show, Leonardo da Vinci, Painter at the Court of Milan. Until next month, goodbye.